history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this amazing country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are heroes around you. Men and women who have risked their lives and gone through things we can only imagine, or in some cases, couldn't even imagine. And we want to make sure that our veterans are honored for their service and sacrifice, that we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And over the next hour, we'll be educated, entertained, and perhaps even inspired, as we are each week, by these stories from our greatest generation. It's very unusual on this show to bring you an interview with a veteran over the telephone, but I think we have pretty good reason to do that today. If you're a regular listener, you'll remember an episode just a couple of weeks ago with Al Scarrett, a 97-year-old Navy veteran in Seattle, who was surprised within the last year by a phone call from the very sailor whose life he had saved on the aircraft carrier USS Bunker Hill after it had been kamikazed in May of 1945. I mentioned at the time that we hoped to bring you a conversation with that man, the sailor who was saved as well, and today we get to do that with 94-year-old Norm Lastman of Chicago, Illinois. I'm excited to bring you that conversation, but my enthusiasm is also tempered by a sobering reality that underscores the urgency of preserving these veteran stories. You're going to hear Norm talk about Al and the remarkable way in which he came to know him. It's a story told very powerfully in television reporting by WGN-TV. I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. It was a book by Robert F. Kennedy's son, Max, that started to fill in some of the blanks in Norm's memory, lost because of the carbon monoxide poisoning he suffered when trapped in the engine room of his aircraft carrier, Norm's involvement with Honor Flight Chicago, and the efforts of a kind-hearted neighbor eventually led to Norm's being able to talk on the phone and even on Skype with the man who saved his life 72 years ago. If you heard Al Scarrett on Hometown Heroes, you know how much it meant to him to learn about Norm. You also heard mentioned that Al, at the time of our interview, was battling leukemia, and I am saddened to report that Norm will never get to experience Al's firm handshake the way I did in Seattle just weeks ago. Al Scarrett passed away on October 6th at the age of 97. I'm so grateful to have shared the time with him that we did, not only to hear his story, but to get a feel for just how special and how giving of a man he was. If you didn't hear Al on the program, you can pull up the full interview at hometownheroesradio.com, and maybe we'll have time to hear a quick clip from that later in the context of Norm's interview today. While Al always wondered who it was he had pulled from that engine room, Norm had no memory from those fateful hours aboard the ship. We're going to get to how that all changed, but let's start, as we do with every veteran, with the early years. Growing up in St. Paul, Minnesota, Norm, what can you tell me about your childhood?
It was nice. I was just, truthfully, when you grew up at that time, it was during your depression, more or less, and you never had much of anything. You enjoyed everything that you had. You know, you walked to school in the snow 13 blocks. I played on the high school football team, and then that's about it. In fact, when I get an opportunity to talk to people, a lot of people, I've never had a date with a girl in high school. I never had the clothes to wear. So that's kind of my high school days.
Do you remember noticing a difference during the Great Depression? Did you notice that things had changed?
Very definitely. I kind of feel that I appreciated everything was given to me, and I expected nothing, and I knew that you had to work. I remember when there was a snowstorm, truthfully, I used to ditch school so we could go out and shovel snow for 25 cents. That's how I made it. And then I brought it home and I had to give it to my dad.
Mm-hmm.
I had a newspaper out for the St. Paul Dispatch. I used to deliver papers at 4 in the morning and the evening. And when I was on the football team, I had my little sister. I taught her how to deliver my papers. But when I collected the money at the end of the month, I had to give it to my dad.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you expected. I never. To me, I have no regrets. I felt thrilled that I could help contribute to the family.
Do you remember as a boy having some ideas, hey, when I grow up, here are the things that I'm going to do? Did you have some of those ambitions?
No. I think the biggest first big surprise of my life is I just was about to graduate from high school when Pearl Harbor was bombed, and I remember the first thing I did was went out trying to sell newspapers at 11 or 12 o'clock at night, yelling on the streets, war declared or something like that, to that effect.
How big of a shock was that?
It was to make a few pennies for us.
How big of a shock was that to you, Norm, to hear that Pearl Harbor had been bombed?
It struck me. As a high school boy, it struck us. The only one thing you want to do is roll up your sleeves and fight.
And how long did you wait before you got in the service?
I had to wait till I graduated high school. We had graduation in December and in June, and we had one graduating. I never went to my graduation because I had left by then in January of 1942.
And obviously, this is the Pacific War we're talking about. It was the Japanese that bombed Pearl Harbor, and that's the part of the war that you would serve in.
Well, that was the shock that shocked the whole country, what happened to Pearl Harbor. And in fact, I was about to join when word got out that if we went to a school for 6 weeks, they would get a job for us. And out of high school, I got a job at the Bremerton Navy Yards, where I worked for about 6 months, and I didn't like it, so I went back home and joined the Navy.
Huh. Well, it's interesting you mentioned Bremerton, because Seattle is where the gentleman who saved your life on the Bunker Hill was from.
That's correct. I lived at the YMCA on 4th Street in Seattle, and I used to take the ferry boat over to Bremerton, where I worked in the Navy Yards. In fact, while I was working there, the battleship Nevada from Pearl Harbor was towed in, and I actually worked on that battleship.
It's occurring to me, all these memories that you're sharing, your story is so unique. Some of these memories didn't
that's
have.
The only thing I've got is a good memory. I can tell you my phone number of my house when I was a boy in grammar school.
But some of these memories disappeared for decades because of what you went through on the Bunker
Hill.
Well,
only what happened aboard ship. Mm-hmm. That's the part of my life. So I can remember just pieces and names and situations. But like, for example, when we got hit and we went to Ulithi, I don't remember going to Ulithi. I don't remember going to Pearl Harbor for minor repairs. I remember getting to Bremerton because that's when I was in Bremerton Navy Yards being repaired. That's when the war ended.
So you did remember everything up until the point where you guys were kamikazed?
There's so many parts that I don't remember, and there's some that I do, and I can't tell you why. But I understand I did not know this, I had carbon monoxide poisoning, and in Maxwell Kennedy's book, there's a whole article about carbon monoxide poisoning where you do forget so many things. And I don't remember so much. I remember Al Scarrett. I'm getting ahead of it, how I got to.
Sure.
You want to hear it now or later?
Well, I'm thinking maybe what we should do is share the story of what triggered all these memories and how this all started to come back to the surface.
When I graduated from electrical school in San Francisco, the Bunker Hill was built on the East Coast and went through the Panama Canal. And when it came up, it came to San Francisco and was anchored out there. And when they told me to grab your sea bags, you're going on your ship, and they never tell you what ship you're going on. And this great big ship that looked like it was 25 stories high when I pulled up to it. And when I boarded the ship, my name was called out, and they told me that I am taking care of the gyro compass. Do you know what the gyro compass is?
Why don't you explain it for everybody listening?
Okay. The gyro compass is it's almost like a wash tub floating. It's a motor that floats in mercury, and it goes 3,600 RPMs. And any time something goes 3,600 RPMs and is floating, it automatically points to north and stays north. And from there, do you get your direction? I would send all the signals to the gun mounts, there's about 23 or 25 compasses throughout the ship. One of them was up in Mark Mitchell's office. In fact, one time I was called up to his office to repair it at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I met him for the first time. He was wearing his bathrobe and his baseball hat, and he had me have a cup of coffee when I finished working on it.
And this was an admiral who was in charge not just of your ship, but the whole fleet.
We were the flagship of the Seventh Fleet.
Yeah. So you're the gyro compass man, and this is a giant aircraft carrier.
The funny thing, though, the one thing in the Navy, when they say jump, you ask how high. When I went aboard, they said, you're in charge of the gyro, and the gyro that they had was an Arma, and I learned on a Sperry. I remember Lieutenant Commander Carmichael was the chief engineer. I told him, I says, I don't know nothing about this one. He says, here's a book. We're leaving in 5 days. You better learn it. And that's what happened. But the Navy was like that. There were so many situations similar to that that we had to, you know, react on a dime and use your own judgment. And I'm sure it caused a lot of problems and a lot of good on both sides.
And you were a plank owner on the Bunker Hill,
correct? I'm a plank owner, right. When we came back after the war was over, they took the hangar deck and converted it to 3,000 bunks were built on there instead of, the level of the aircraft carrier is a hangar deck.
Right.
They took, instead of putting airplanes on there, the war was over. We went back to the Philippines with bunks with 3,000. We brought 3,000 Marines back from the Philippines, and that's when I got discharged.
And a lot happened in between. In those 18 months.
It was in 11 major battles. We were hit maybe 6-7 times. I've been through Bremerates for repairs. Then we went back out to sea. Then we got hit with the big one with two kamikazes. And that's something I'll never forget.
Well, and I know so much of your story and your ability to tell your story centers around May 11th of 45 and what happened when you were hit.
1945 at 7:30 in the morning.
But I want to hear about before that, because you just gave us a taste. I mean, that was your 11th major battle of World War II.
I've been on every island in the South Pacific. I have 11 stars and the presidential citation.
Mm-hmm. And you have your life, and you have another sailor to thank for it, and we're going to hear about that. But I want to hear what you remember about some of those earlier battles before we get into Okinawa and when you were
there. Funny thing you say that. Would you believe this? I was on the ship for 3 years, and only once did I ever see a Japanese plane coming and firing at us. Why? Because although I was the chief gyro engineer, whenever the gong, gong, gong of battle stations were sounded, I was assigned to Interim Room 2, and my chief engineer was Joseph Carmichael, who was in Engine Room 1. And I would wear sound-powered phones, and he would give me instructions on when and how to switch generators to whatever he wanted, because he had his own way of running it. In fact, at one time after we were hit, the word spread around. I don't know if it was the captain who said it or scuttlebutt, whatever it was, abandoned ship. There was only three of us left in the engine room. We could not see down there, only because by going down there for 3 years, do you know your way around by feeling? We could not see. The smoke was so burnt. And I don't know if you're aware of it. They have a air duct that goes down to each engine room. It's about 6 feet wide. I used to sit under it and read the book. In fact, I read the book War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy. Well, on watch, because you're four on and eight off all around the clock. And I was in the engine room for 4 hours, and many times all you had to do was switch generators and nothing else to do. I'd read a book. Mm-hmm. But it was so hot down there. It was 130 degrees. I stood under the ventilator. But I found out those two ventilators going down the engine rooms were improperly made at the shipbuilding plant. And it brought all fumes and smoke and that down until it started exhausting it. I remember seeing the shaft after I came up, and afterwards the elevator shafts melted like butter. Now, when I was in the engine room, when they said abandon ship, we climbed up the ladder trying to get out, and you had the port, like a porthole door to open, and when the three of us were on the ladder, water poured down. The minute we opened, we had to close it and hurry, and we knew that we couldn't get out. That's the only way to get out of the engine room was out through that one door. And there's one guy that they taught us that when they suffocate, they swallow their tongue. I took a pliers and tried to pull the tongue out of a guy, but it didn't work. He died. And then I don't remember anymore. I remember falling asleep somewhere. It's like going to sleep. you know, carbon monoxide poisoning. It just like going to sleep.
Yeah.
And I remember going to sleep, and the next thing I know is there's somebody's carrying me, and that's Al Skerritt. And I never knew who he was because he brought me up to the flight deck and laid me on. I had no shoes on. I don't know what happened to my shoes. And later on, I found my compartment was completely blown. I had no clothes to wear. I found a pillowcase and cut the corners out and used them for pants until we get to Ulithi, or I think Ulithi, where I got some clothes to wear.
Mm-hmm.
And I wore these. I wore a pillowcase with a piece of rope around me till we got to Ulithi. In fact, I wore the pillowcase to the funeral, the burial at sea, when that 10 at a time went over the side.
It's time for our first break, but we'll piece together more of Norm Lastman's story when we come back. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find a link to the book that would fill in so many of the details in Norm's story and eventually lead him to the man who saved his life 72 years ago. If you haven't seen that award-winning TV report on their reunion from WGN in Chicago, you really need to check that out. It's online for you there as well. More from Norm when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Effler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.